This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Every time our nation goes into a period of torturing opponents, it seems like an extraordinary need.
They see it as an exception because they're looking at it in kind of isolation. They're not thinking about how others have done it before.
Historian Fitzhugh Brundage talks about the American tradition of torture. Plus, community college enrollment fell again this year. Ryan Denham talks with the director of the Illinois Community College Board. And Laura Kennedy brings us a story of hedonism, apathy, and totalitarianism. It still has legs. Cabaret.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Nobody wants a bad economy. But the historically low unemployment we're seeing in Illinois is taking a toll on its 48 community colleges. Enrollment fell about 4% this fall, and it's down 14%, roughly, over the last 5 years. WGLT's Ryan Denham spoke with Illinois Community College Board Executive Director Brian Durham about why that's happening.
It's always concerning for the colleges to see declines in enrollment, but I think that it clearly reflects the inverse relationship between the economy and enrollment in particularly among adult students and in career and technical education programs. Our enrollments in transfer and our high school enrollments, they do not cause that sort of dip in the same way that our CTE and adult ed does. And that usually is a reflection of the fact that people have employment, and so they're not having to come back and get training. But certainly, even so, colleges worry about enrollment, the state worries about enrollment, and everybody does everything they can to reach out to students and try to recruit and bring those numbers up, you know, and actually it drives a lot of innovation, I think.
So is this something that is happening at community college systems across the country?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This is a national trend. Our neighbors, Indiana, Missouri, Kentucky, I mean, all have had similar enrollment declines, some greater than others. But I think you could go to just about any state in the union and you would see similar enrollment declines.
So if kind of fluctuations in the economy are, they're perceived to be to some degree temporary, I guess, how do you respond to a decline like this? But do so in a way that is not an overreaction, you know, not mm-hmm. stepping out in front of the economy too much.
Yeah, sure. I mean, certainly, I mean, first of all, I'm not an economist, so, you know, I can't speak to the intricacies and the details of changes in the economy. But I will say that nobody wants a bad economy, and certainly nobody wishes for that. And so colleges just continue to provide the good services that they do. They continue to provide those opportunities for training. They look in, you know, every nook and cranny that they can for recruitment opportunities. They try to partner with businesses, and they always remain prepared to serve those students if something does happen and the economy takes a downturn. And I think that's really important point that, you know, community colleges are really that hub for their community. You know, 97% of students that go to a community college work and live in the district where they go to that college. And so they're there in good times and bad to help their community and their workers and their businesses and that local economy.
So with unemployment being as low as it is, there have been reports of different industries that have had trouble finding enough qualified workers to fill certain types of positions. Can you cite a few examples of what community colleges in your system have done to kind of adapt to the types of jobs, types of industries that are looking for trained workers?
Sure. So I'll address it in two ways. I mean, one is community colleges really work to stay on the cutting edge of what folks need. So one of the growing areas in the state and industry and such, for example, is cybersecurity. And so you have a lot of colleges that are now working with partners in their districts that are implementing cybersecurity programs trying to respond to that changing workforce. I mean, one of the things that's a challenge for all of us is that, you know, everything changes happening more and more rapidly each year. And so the community colleges work really hard to keep up with that. You know, one of the areas that employers often cite that's a challenge is what I'll call essential skills or soft skills. And that's things like learning how to work in a team, making sure that you understand, you know, the workers understand how to show up for work, what is required of them. And community colleges infuse all of that into their curriculum as well. So you'll go to a program at a college, and maybe it's a welding program. They may have folks come in and punch a time clock as a part of that program. You know, they may have specific requirements about when they need to show up. Certainly they emphasize things like safety protocols. So they try to really build all that stuff into the programs basically come out with, a worker who's qualified and ready to go. The other thing I will add that occurs to me is that every program, every career program in the state has an advisory committee of employers and industry from their region. So Illinois Central College, for example, is very likely in the programs that they have to be, have representation from Caterpillar. I don't think I speak out of turn to say that that I would expect that Caterpillar is very strongly represented across their career program. Similarly, you're going to have in places where healthcare is a big industry, you're going to have the hospitals that are on there. And so they're informing the curriculum and they're helping the colleges understand what they need with their workers.
Most of what we've been talking about up to this point has been on sort of the adult education side. What are you guys seeing in terms of enrollment trends related to those younger students, you know, those that want to do a year or two at a community college before transferring to a four-year institution? They're, you know, more in that late teen, early 20s age gap.
Generally speaking, our enrollment in transfer areas is pretty steady. We see... we are certainly seeing a smaller high school class, right? You know, so one of our challenges in Illinois is that we have a completion goal of 60 by 2025. And so we really need those high school students alongside the adult students as well to try to meet that goal. But I would say it's remaining pretty steady. You know, you have students that plan to transfer are still going to community colleges, and they're still transferring. And actually, they're very successful. We are number one among the top community or among the top systems when it comes to the success of community college transfer students in Illinois, or in the country, I'm sorry.
My understanding is there is a pretty big cliff coming in about 2025, where we're going to have even fewer high school graduating students in Illinois. And I'm curious as to how you guys are preparing for that moment at the community college level, what that sort of drop-off is going to mean for you guys.
Well, I mean, I think it all comes down to recruitment and retention and marketing the colleges as the most affordable option, making sure that the public understands that in order to increase your earnings over a lifetime, you have to have some kind of post-secondary credential, and all the statistics support that. That doesn't have to be a four-year degree. That can be a two-year degree. That can be a certificate program. That can be a shorter-term certificate program. But certainly, we have to demonstrate the value of community college and remind the system, and colleges are doing this, and we're doing it, that community college is the affordable option. Community college is right there in the community to serve you, and community colleges offer an array of programs beyond just what people think of as traditional college. So there's a lot of opportunity. Also, we've been working very hard as a system to look at remedial education and come up with ways that we can shorten the time for students who are in remediation, that we can make sure that students have opportunity to get into credit-bearing coursework as soon as possible. One of the things we do, for example, is we run what are called integrated education and training programs in many colleges around the state. And that's where a student can be enrolled in adult education and a career course at the same time so they can get credit and basic skills. We're doing similar things on the credit side with what's called co-requisite remediation, where a student might be taking a remedial course but also getting extra support so they can get through that very quickly so they can get into credit. So we're looking at a variety of strategies. You know, we have a number of colleges that are doing what's called guided pathways, where they are working to define very specifically what pathway a student should be on so that they understand what they're getting into and so that they can move through those as quickly as possible.
Community colleges are obviously known for being a very affordable option to students. That said, I wonder if you have any thoughts on whether there is enough financial aid available for community college students, either coming from the federal government or the state government. We kind of think of financial aid as, you know, being in the purview of this kind of very traditional 18-year-old going to a four-year institution. What about your students? Is there a need for more aid for your types of students?
Well, certainly we would support, and I think the system would support, additional MAP funding. I know that the governor has talked about additional MAP funding and advocating for that. And community colleges take advantage of MAP funding as well as students that are going to four-year institutions. So we would definitely advocate for that. There, you know, on the Pell side, I think that certainly more opportunity to support students would be great. I mean, we want to make sure that every student that attends a community college has an opportunity. If they want to, they have that opportunity and they have that support. So I think there's certainly room for additional aid. What exactly that looked like is I'll leave that to the policymakers to have that discussion. But we would support more aid for sure.
In our neck of the woods here in McLean County, we've had our largest school district, Unit 5, embark on some pretty interesting dual credit programs with Heartland Community College in Normal. Even going so far as to do offer a full associate's degree four-year plan in the computer science area. What are you guys seeing in sort of the dual credit space statewide? Are we still seeing an increase in those offerings?
Dual credit increases has increased every year for the last decade, and we expect to see continued growth in dual credit.
Why is that? Why now?
Well, I think it comes down to affordability and readiness. I mean, if students are ready for college and they can do the work, then they deserve that opportunity to do that work, even if they're in high school. You know, if you can, it has to be rigorous and it has to be quality. But if students are ready, they should have that opportunity. And then also, it is typically very discounted, if not free. And so for parents, you get students into a dual credit, and you may have an opportunity to earn 3, 6, 9, 12, you know, sometimes, as you mentioned, a full degree while you're in high school. And that's a huge cost saving. And I think it is just one more way to point to the affordability of the community college. For community colleges, it's an opportunity to partner with K-12. It is certainly a pipeline for recruitment for students who, you know, get a couple of credits and then they go on to the community college. And some places do that very well. And so that, you know, they're making good connections. And it all comes back to that community college mission. It's their job to serve their community, and this is just one more way they can do it.
That's Brian Durham, Executive Director of the Illinois Community College Board, speaking with WGLT's Ryan Denham. You can see an interactive graphic showing enrollment at several downstate colleges, including Heartland, at our website, WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from Westminster Village, a locally owned and operated not-for-profit for over 40 years and now expanding the campus in Bloomington. New Westminster Village assisted living and memory support facilities currently under construction. Details at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, life is a cabaret, Laura Kennedy reports. America has a tradition of torture, from enhanced interrogation during the Iraq War and struggle against Al-Qaeda, all the way back to the Salem witch trials. Torture has featured prominently in this country's history. Fitzhugh Brundage is the author of a Pulitzer Prize finalist book on how Americans excuse torture at certain times in the life of the Republic. He's also coming to ISU at 7 p.m. Thursday, November 14th in the old main room of the Bone Student Center at Illinois State University. In this Sound Ideas preview, we talk with Brundage about how torture comes during moments of national stress or to control populations such as slaves. Brundage says it flows from a feeling of powerlessness.
The resort to torture has been a reflection of the frustration of Americans in positions of power who have felt threatened by enemies that they did not believe either fought by conventional or traditional means of fighting, or else were so insidious that some extreme measures were needed. I would describe it as a sense of that the impulse to resort to torture is a response to what people in power, the powers that be, perceive to be an extraordinary circumstance that requires extraordinary measures. And so they see it as an exception because they're looking at it in kind of isolation. They're not thinking about how others have done it before, and so they're not drawing connections, historical connections, the way, as a scholar, I am.
That fits the case for torture during the President Bush years. That fits the case for torture during World War II, although war crimes are more common than not common in armed conflict. And it fits the witch trials in Salem, too, if you're thinking of witches as an existential threat to community or civilized life that those people did. How does it fit the case of severe threat or perceived imbalance of power in modern policing or in slavery?
Certainly. In both cases, the implication of your question is slaveholders had unlimited power over their slaves, so why did they perceive themselves as having an existential threat, or modern police have, you know, such enormous capacity to impose their will on population? So what I think that's a very good question, because it gets at the root of the matter is, in essence, the perception of people in power about the threat they face. In the case of modern policing, I think it's been tied to a number of forces or influences, but especially a rhetoric of the war on crime, the idea that there is a thin blue line that stands between ordered society, law-abiding society, and this other world that is completely violent and anarchic, and that the police are really the only thing that is preventing the rest of the civilization, American civilization, of being overrun by criminals who are amoral and nihilistic. They'll just destroy everything. And that rhetoric of the war on crime has been so deeply embedded into the language of American public life from the 1960s on up through, especially during the 1990s and 1980s, when particularly the crack epidemic stoked fears of super predators. It gave police a license to adopt extreme measures because it seemed warranted if you're fighting a war against crime. Going back to the era of slavery, there, in a sense, the slaveholders didn't have to work hard to dehumanize slaves because the enslaved African Americans were already considered to be less than white humans in all manner of intelligence and capacity for feeling emotions and obligation, et cetera, et cetera. And so if the population that needs to be controlled is already dehumanized, then there are fewer constraints. And then on top of that, there's the license that was given to slaveholders to chastise, punish their enslaved humans as they saw fit. And so there was really no limit on the capacity of slaveholders to devise methods of punishment, which sometimes extended to a violence that we would describe outright as torture. They themselves saw it as simply the method that was needed to keep their enslaved people in check.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker talking with Fitzhugh Brundage, a historian and a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's also the author of Civilizing Torture, an American Tradition, and an upcoming speaker at Illinois State University. There is a strand of thought that suggests that the war on crime, the war on drugs, and by extension some of the torture behavior that went with that was motivated, driven politically by racism. And yet you're talking about the fear of a loss of civilization to justify extraordinary and unwholesome means of suppressing crime. Is it possible to tease out race from that fear, or are they entwined?
I think you're absolutely right. They are entwined. The notion that Europeans, that is, white Europeans, were creating the most refined, elevated, sophisticated human civilization ever achieved was deeply embedded in both European and American thought by the 19th century. So the idea that civilization is not the idea of civilization is not somehow race blind by any means. It was deeply informed by the notion that the only people who could create an advanced civilization were white Europeans or Euro-Americans. So that's absolutely, if you will, racialized from its conception. But in the 20th century, I think as the United States has moved away from, or I should say the public discourse in the United States has moved away from an outright avowal of white superiority, the rhetoric of white supremacy and white superiority has diminished. And instead, we can have rhetoric of civilization being preserved, whether it be against the onslaught of criminals. And the criminals don't really have to be specifically identified as people of color. It's almost taken for granted. And likewise, you don't have to describe terrorists in the white imagination as being specifically non-American and non-white. Often when the term during the war on terrorism was used, war on terror, the languages of terrorists virtually assumed that all terrorists were non-white, non-American. And we often don't use the term terrorist to describe white Americans who are carrying out violence against Americans in a terrorist mode. So I think you're absolutely right. The two are sort of bound together, and it's in that sense, civilization becomes a code word for all of the things that we think are most positive and valuable and important to preserve about the United States. And barbarism or savagery or whatever the opposite of civilization is often becomes synonymous with characteristics associated with people of color.
Is it easier to justify it if we think ourselves virtuous, or is it, does it require more rhetorical hoop jumping than if we did not think ourselves so virtuous?
Well, I think it does make it, another wonderful question, because I think it gets at a tension, because the idea of the United States as being founded on a body of principles and law that are humane and progressive. I mean that progressive in the long sense of the word from the 19th century on. The idea that somehow Americans are, to use Abraham Lincoln's phrase, the last best hope for humankind, that that notion is a powerful break, if you will, or obstacle to violations of our principles. And yet the idea that those principles of the United States are so sacred that they must be preserved against an existential threat can then also energize those who say, well, we don't like to do this, we don't like to adopt these methods, but given our circumstances, there's no alternative. We must fight our enemies with the tools that we have at our disposal. So in a sense, those same values can, or appeals to those virtues, can lead in two different directions. And I think that's why, at the same time that there has been a recurring resort to torture at times of crisis or perceived crisis in the United States, there has also been strong opposition to the resort to torture.
And yet torture still happens. So
yes.
the rebound, the opposition is either not very effective or it's a function of rebound once it becomes known.
Yes, I think you're right. The challenge is always that I hesitate to use this analogy because it sounds flip, but it's the challenge is sort of like playing whack-a-mole in that the places, if you will, where the occurrences of violations of American principles or the use of torture can pop up, and then activist opponents will target those and call for some sort of measures. But it's very hard to, because of the dispersal of authority in the United States with so many different police entities, so many different branches of government having some sort of authority to exercise power over American citizens, it's really hard to ensure that some of those entities aren't engaging in violation. So, I mean, we should not lose sight of the fact that, for example, the Supreme Court over the course of the 20th century made extraordinary inroads in trying to hamper violations of citizens' rights by the police. And to the extent that those violations have continued, those violations have almost always been flagrant violations of norms that the Supreme Court and other courts have tried to establish. The examples of police torture in Chicago and Los Angeles and other cities are literally outright violations of the law and can be punished. The challenge, of course, is to marshal the kind of public will, if you will, the institutional will to punish police forces or sheriff's departments that get out of line. So the challenge then for opponents of torture is to anticipate where violations might happen, to gather together the kind of legal evidence that is necessary to confront often powerful institutions, powerful branches of the government, and to do that in an environment where sometimes there is, for example, during the war on crime, there was a rhetoric that was not sympathetic at all to the rights of alleged criminals, or for that matter, to criminals. I wouldn't want to exaggerate the capacity of the values, if you will, the professed values of American law and civilization to stop torture, but they have a capacity to be marshaled against it and prevent it from continuing, if you will. So they can box it in, if you will.
Fitzhugh Brundage is the author of Civilizing Torture, an American Tradition, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He's also a speaker at ISU, where the title of his speech will be The Third Degree, Policing and the American Tradition of Torture. So your comments suggest that torture by police ought to be becoming a little more rare based on Supreme Court action and laws curbing the power of police. But police also operate in a constant state of existential awareness that they are representing law. So are they not more prone to torture than perhaps some other areas of public life? And what is the trend for police torture based on those two separate themes there?
I hesitate to make any sort of broad claim about the trend. I do think it is important to recognize that what we may now call police brutality was routine police practice in many, many, many American cities in the early 20th century. To the extent that there were any controls on it, it depended on the police supervisor or superintendent or commissioner, whatever the title might be, in any given city and his preferences. I think it was routine in the early 20th century. I think it'd be fair to say now that there are many, many police departments in the United States where police brutality is uncommon. That's not to suggest that it isn't still a serious national problem. Broadly speaking, I think I will hazard that there has been a decline in the prevalence of police torture across the 20th century. That has many reasons, certainly in part due to the Supreme Court, but also the police now have more and more resources at their disposal to develop evidence that can be used to convict criminals. Whereas in the early 20th century, they had no forensic capacity, they were poorly trained, and they essentially relied on their brawn to elicit confessions, which they could then use to secure convictions. But where I think the problem is really prevalent is in those communities where there really is a sense of chronic lawlessness. And you add that chronic lawlessness with police forces that may perceive themselves as being the thin blue line between law and order and the end of the world. That's the kind of environment where I think we can anticipate that there are going to be police skirting with the very fringes of the law or violating the laws regarding criminals' rights and for that matter, human rights. And remind me of the second part of your question.
The question is, you know, if we've got laws that make it tougher and we have an institutional force that makes it more attractive, how are these two to exist in tension going forward?
That's a very important question. We can envision all manner of possible reforms, sort of piecemeal reforms that might help. That is, every interrogation has to be videotaped or filmed. But, for example, if you make that a rule, then the abuse can happen off the camera. It's very, you know, sort of piecemeal reforms are a tremendous challenge because there'll be those who find ways to skirt them. However, I do think what has been demonstrated over the course of the 20th century is that a kind of continual attention to this, particularly by the courts, it's in response to changing behavior by police forces, but nevertheless, the response can continue to try to suppress whatever new tactics police forces may be using, developing, to violate the rights of alleged criminals or citizens. More broadly, I think the issue is continuing to raise awareness and develop communication across activist groups that are monitoring police behavior across the United States, I think is really important. And I think that has been aided by, of course, advent of internet and the capacity to develop archives of information and share them almost effortlessly and instantaneously. But also, I think the awareness of episodes of police brutality in Chicago, in Los Angeles, and as part of the Black Lives Matter movement has really elevated attention to this to a level that we haven't seen in decades.
attention is fleeting sometimes, and your book suggests that torture recurs at moments of stress. There will always be moments of stress in society.
Correct. And so it's as you recount it like that, it's rather depressing. Yes, so I don't want to suggest that I think that it's pointless to try to do anything to address the issue of torture. I think it's, if you will, a moral and societal obligation to try to anticipate where torture might arise and to respond to it very, very quickly with arguments against its allowing it to continue and efforts to try to bring those responsible for torture into courts as quickly as possible. But I do think you're right that, broadly speaking, we can anticipate that it's a very predictable response that when threatened, certain groups, those who have the capacity to do it, will resort to violence. In that regard, the challenge of being ready to confront torture is a persistent, enduring one. But it's a challenge that I just can't see any way for us to shirk. If American institutions, laws, and principles are to be more than just idle words, it's an obligation of for us to enforce them.
This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media, and you're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Fitzhugh Brundage, historian, is our guest. Earlier, you talked about the idea a society that believes itself a bastion of civilization might actually be more prone to torture because it is defending something that is very precious. Is that American exceptionalism run amok, or is this just par for the course for any advanced civilization?
Excellent question. I certainly do not believe that the United States is a nation that has a tradition of torture on the scale of some other nations during crisis. I might pick Chile during the late 1970s and 1980s, Argentina in the 1970s and 1980s, Zimbabwe for decades, and I could go on and on, North Korea. Those are societies which I think are in a state of truly profound crisis in which torture reaches levels, extreme levels. I don't want to suggest that the United States somehow should be located on some list of perpetrators of torture on a list like that. But your question does get to a good point, which is I think torture is most likely to happen in societies which, as you suggested, are in crisis. But especially societies that are in crisis in which there are great inequalities in power or there are inequalities that are rooted in stark racial, well, this has to do with power, but stark racial or class divisions. And so in the United States, when you combine, not every crisis, I think, is necessarily, not every existential crisis is necessarily going to produce torture. One could have imagined, for example, during the Cold War era, leaving aside the issue of police torture, during the Cold War in the United States, it's not as though the incredible fear of communists in the United States during the 1950s led the FBI to adopt torture to identify communists all over the place. And I think that partially reflected the fact that the FBI and anti-communists tended to identify a type of people as threats who could be gotten at, if you will, without resorting to torture. They, in other words, were enemies, but they weren't dehumanized enemies that somehow fit for torture. And it also had to do with the fact that we were using accusations of torture in the Soviet Union as an example of how our principles were superior to the Soviet Union's principles. So all of this is to say that I think that torture is more likely in moments of crisis even in an advanced society. But one can anticipate, and in fact one can find examples of societies, advanced societies, where they have criminal justice systems that are not as prone to torture as the United States, or that have gone through crises without resorting to torture as we have.
Fitzhugh Brundage is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, a Pulitzer Prize finalist for his book, Civilizing Torture and American Tradition. He'll be speaking at Illinois State University. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Fitzhugh Brundage will be the Robert Bone Lecturer at ISU Thursday, November 14th in the old main room of the Bone Student Center at 7 p.m.
Support for GLT comes from Fox & Hounds Hair Salon and Day Spa, surrounding you with care and attention from head to toe, providing a full range of hair, nail, and massage services for men and women. 200 West Monroe in downtown Bloomington. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet. Writer Christopher Isherwood's novel Goodbye Berlin began life as a book, then became a stage play, then a Broadway musical called Cabaret. A hit Hollywood film followed. The story of hedonism, apathy, and totalitarianism still has legs and is coming to community players. WGLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy speaks with the director, who reveals the timing has never been better to stage this musical.
Community Players in Bloomington presents the multi-award-winning Candor-Inev musical, Cabaret.
Welcome and bienvenue, welcome in Cabaret, oh Cabaret.
Set in the decadent and desperate days of post-World War I Berlin, the show follows a struggling writer looking for inspiration at a seedy nightclub. Directed by John D. Poling, this version is based on the 1989 Broadway production, which Poling says has the level of grit that perfectly projects the mood of the show.
In the 1966 musical, they kind of whitewash some things. You know, it's based on Christopher Isherwood's life kind of thing. In the musical, he is Cliff, all right? And in the original version, Cliff is straight and all that stuff. And Isherwood was unapologetically gay. Our Cliff is, or the Cliff of 1998 is bisexual, probably. We don't really know kind of thing. It's much more clear in the second act how much has deteriorated in Berlin just in this short amount of time, this few months of time or whatever. You know, in the Liza Minnelli version in the movie, life as a cabaret is this cheerful, upbeat kind of thing. But in the 98 version, it's basically Sally falling apart.
So why does this story still resonate with us today?
Oh my gosh, it resonates now more than ever, which is really why I wanted to direct it.
All right, tell us why.
All right, because you cannot, as an audience member, sit out there smugly in those seats and say, oh, isn't that an interesting, entertaining, cautionary tale? Because the scapegoating of the other is happening now more than ever. While certainly we have nothing on the scale of the Holocaust, we certainly have groups that are being basically persecuted because of who they are, and merely because they're the other, all right? And if you ask yourself, well, gosh, how far can something like that actually go? Come to Cabaret and see how far it can go.
So the version that you're working from, the one from the 90s, emphasized the grit. Tell me how you're accomplishing grit.
Well, for one thing is that when the audience comes, the set is very simplistic. There is nothing particularly flashy about it, which I really think is kind of true to how it would be in Berlin, Germany, because cabarets were unreputable. And you will see that, particularly with the performances and with the costumes and things like that, right? But even the costumes aren't particularly fancy or flashy or that kind of thing, right? They're risque and they're sexually liberated women, you know, that are dancing in them and that kind of thing. You know, the only time I would think a respectable mainstream Berliner would come to the cabaret would be to kind of be slumming kind of thing and see what the other half, the bawdiness and that kind of thing. That's the impression that we want to give with this production, is it's maybe it's in a basement somewhere kind of thing. It's definitely, there's not a lot of money to it. There's just a small little orchestra of women who are basically kind of by the second act just doing it for the money kind of thing. They're just fed up with it. It's not glitzy by any stretch of the imagination.
We have the character of Cliff. What draws Cliff to the cabaret?
He is basically kind of a frustrated novelist who is just looking for inspiration and, you know, seeing new places and new people and that kind of thing. There's a line early on in the rooming house that he lives in. One of the women is clearly a lady of the evening, prostitute, that kind of thing, right? And it's very quickly made clear to Cliff that that's what she does. And the landlady, Frau Schneider, says, you know, don't worry, I'll keep her away from you. And he says, no, please don't, right? This is exactly the kind of person that I'm looking for, that I want to write about.
You also said that there's some warnings within the play, as in be careful demonizing others and that sort of thing. Is there perhaps a warning against hedonism and allowing hedonism to rule your life to the point where you don't see danger?
I think there's some of that that's implied, but you would have to tease that message out on your own, I think, in it. You know, I mean, how much did that contribute to the overall situation? Was the rise of the Nazis somehow a backlash to this, you know, sexual freedom and homosexuality and, you know, drug use and the other things that are portrayed in the musical?
Well, we talked about Cliff. Let's talk about some of the other characters. And one who spends a lot of time center stage is the MC. Tell us about the MC.
Well, the MC is an interesting character because the MC really exists kind of in two worlds. In our case, we have cast a female as MC. She is physically there in the cabaret and is the host and that kind of thing. But she's also kind of a merry prankster that is there to kind of provoke people.
We have no troubles here. Here, life is beautiful. The girls are beautiful. Even the orchestra is beautiful.
And shows up in other scenarios within the show that it's like, well, wait, how did she get into the train car? Or how is she over here kind of thing? But that's the idea, that she basically kind of transcends the world that we're living in and also is on this other plane of existence as well. But, you know, she mainly is there to not only provoke the eventual rise of the Nazis, but to also provoke us as well as audience members and, you know, maybe our own complacency about things.
So you have a woman playing the MC. Was it a deliberate casting choice to have the MC be female, or did you just say, I'm going to cast whichever performer's right?
A little bit of both. I certainly did not go out with the idea of casting a woman in it, but I was certainly very open to the idea. And Kenzie, who we have cast in the role, you know, it was clear from her audition, it was like she had the goods to do it, right? I mean, because it takes a lot, not just to be the singing ability and that kind of thing, but also the interaction with the audience and that kind of personality, but then also later on the dramatic chops that you need for it as well. And so I was thrilled when she came and auditioned and we found her. And I do like the idea of not going with the traditional male choice as MC.
Let's talk about Sally Bowles.
Well, we have a phenomenal actress who is playing Sally. Her name is Lauren Hickel. And she's young. I mean, she's early 20s, which is actually the age that the real Sally Bowles was. I think, in actuality, when Isherwood met, and I think her name was Jane Reed, who he made in the book Sally Bowles, she was something like 19, but she had lived a hard life. And so it's very difficult to find an actress that's that young but understands the kind of things that someone in their 30s, 40s, or 50s would understand in terms of life being lived kind of thing.
Are you making any changes with regards to the music? Have you cut any songs or switched anything around, or are you sticking pretty close to it?
No, we're pretty much doing it as is. We haven't made any changes whatsoever, really, I can think of with the music. We have tried to make it clear that this is definitely, because of the subject matter and a few bits of language and things, but this is definitely something that should be considered rated R, you know. So I would say anybody, like a movie, over the 17, you should, you know, talk to your parents about, is this something that you want to see? I think it's good for younger people to see it, but it's definitely adult content, and it can definitely be, for some people, triggering, because, you know, by the end, it does deal with the Holocaust and things, and, you know, that's pretty intense.
As a director, what do you hope when the audiences are walking out? What do you hope are they talking about?
I really hope They are moved, and I think they will be. It's a powerful production. I told the actors the first meeting that we got together was that the audience may really hate us at the end, and you know what? That's okay. I mean,
why? Why would they hate you?
I'm not going to spoil the ending for you, but I mean, it's a really intense, not a happy ending.
That's John D. Poling, director of Cabaret, running at Community Players in Bloomington November 8th through the 24th. I'm Laura Kennedy.
To help make live theater more accessible, Community Players is offering a pay-what-you-can preview of Cabaret November 7th. The show starts at 7:30 and seats are on a first-come, first-served basis. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Ryan Denham and Laura Kennedy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.